Wow, thank you very much. Very, very much. It's nice to be with you all. I've never been to Mount Hermon. It's the first time for me. So it's like, it's the Holy Grail. Is it Mount Hermon I don't know. It's the first time I've been to this conference, the first time I've been to Mount Hermon. And so, you know, nervous coming up, going to a new place, and then walking into so many old friends, seeing just a bunch of faces of old friends. It feels a little bit like a reunion. It's just been great to be here, to be able to worship with you and to spend some time with you together. Being on the same dais as Dale Bruner, now that's intimidating. That's because Dale's one of the few people who was there when Henrietta Mears was talking to Jesus. And he remembers the page numbers that they were talking about. So, but I'm going to tell one Dale Bruner story because I want this to set the record straight. Dale has been teaching a Bible study. Are you still teaching at Hollywood Press? Are you still there? He's been teaching a Bible study at Hollywood Press ever since he came back down to California from Whitworth. I just want everybody to know that it was my idea, okay? I'm the one who recruited him. People are taking credit all over the place. I was the pastor of Christian education. I recruited Dale Bruner. They don't remember me for anything at Hollywood Press, except for he's the guy who let Dale Bruner take over the Sunday school class, and that might be the best thing I ever did there. So, Dale, it's wonderful to be with you. Thank you for the chance just to spend time with you. And I noticed they didn't put you up against the NCAA finals. They gave you a better slot. So, yeah. Those of you texting on your phone, you know, the... Just try to time, you know. Just try to time the yays with my points. Is all I ask. Make sure this thing works. Does this work? See, this is great. I should always travel with an 11-year-old. Is what I think. No. Okay, how about one of this? That work? Yeah, there you go. Okay. Ronald Heifetz: leadership is disappointing your own people at a rate they can absorb. My favorite quote about leadership. I've basically been going around the country for the past 3 years saying this quote wherever I can go, reminding folks that leadership itself is an act of making people really, really uncomfortable with you, and that and it's trying to do that in such a way that they don't fire you immediately. That our hope and intention whenever we spend time together as leaders is to try to find ways that we can help people become what they don't want to become. My brief history about me. I spent 10 glorious years at Hollywood Presbyterian Church. It was one of the great privileges of my life to work on staff there. Went to Fuller Theological Seminary, did 2 degrees. I spent so much time there that I had to go back and visit the David Allen Hubbard Library because I think my overdue library books built most of the place. Ended up writing a PhD dissertation that became the book It Takes a Church to Raise a Christian, and around that same time that I was finishing up that degree, I went to San Clemente Presbyterian Church, where I've been there for 16 glorious years. I asked the Lord to give me a place where I could raise my children and where I could lead a congregation that wanted to make an impact in their community, and God gave me the desires of my heart. It's been an absolute joy. I went there when my son was 3 years old, when my daughter was 3 months. My daughter and Tony's daughter became friends. They are famously still remembered to this day for being two little girls who kicked kids off the trikes in the preschool playground saying, "Our daddies run this church. This is our..." Grace and Allie were famous then. Now my daughter is a beautiful 16-year-old who has her own car and kicks me out of the car, actually. I was part of doing some work with Los Ranchos Presbytery. We did a reorganization work in my presbytery. I love the presbytery I'm in. I just feel like it's a wonderful place. And because of that, I got a chance to do some stuff for the General Assembly for a couple of years. That was less exciting than the experience I had in Los Ranchos. But what it did is it taught me a lot about some of the challenges of leadership that we're all facing. And so most of what I want to share to you today has come out of the experiences that I've had at these places. It all started for me and when I met some folks from TAG Consulting. Kevin Ford wrote a book called The Transforming Church. The G in Kevin's name stands for Graham. He's in the Billy Graham family. Leighton Ford is his dad. Kevin wrote the book The Transforming Church, and I asked Kevin to come in and help our church during a time of transition. We'd had 10 years of growth. Things were going well by all the numerical standards, but I could sense that there was something wrong in the church, that way that only pastors can sense. You know that sense when your best people are stepping out of ministry? When the people who you want most engage are saying that they need to step back from leadership, that it seems to be kind of a beginning of that sense of malaise. Most of the time we tell ourselves it's just fine, we'll be fine, we just need to do a sermon series on Revelation or something, it'll get everybody fired up. And And what I found, though, was there was some work that we needed to do that I didn't understand how to frame it. I ended up learning a bunch from these guys, and I spend some time with them now, part-time consulting. I'm kind of like an Amway salesman for TAG. I sell a little bit of their soap. I get to use a lot of their soap. And it helps me to learn a bunch about how I apply things back into our context, and a bunch of the stuff I'll share with you today comes from the work that I did with, have learned from them. But it all started for me one afternoon with the Maine Methodists. I was asked to fly back to Maine to work with a group of Christian educators, about this many folks, all of them doing Christian education, pastors, Christian educators, lay leaders, associate pastors. And they came and I did three presentations on my book, all about spiritual formation and Christian community, the way in which spiritual formation, Christian community, and the kingdom of God all help us frame and shape disciples. At the end of the three presentations, they decided they'd ask me if I would do one of those kind of speaker talkback times. You know, like anybody who wants to come and ask a question can basically get one more talk out of the speaker since we got them out here. And 60 people showed up for it. It was kind of interesting. Now, my wife's a therapist, so what she always tells you is that in a group of 60 people, the extroverts are going to win. So she taught me a little technique where basically I took a second and I went around the room and I asked everybody there to give me one sentence or one word on why they came, what they wanted to talk about. Because that way I could take, instead of having whoever talks first, whoever talked the topic people want to talk about the most, we talk about. The first person said to me, I want to hear more about how your work in Africa is helping you with spiritual formation. I said, great, Africa. And then 59 other people all had the exact same question. They all said in one way or another, they said the question that they wanted to talk about was, what can we do to keep our churches from dying? What was interesting to me is that I hadn't talked about churches dying. I hadn't talked about church growth. I hadn't talked about anything like that. I'd come to talk about spiritual formation and Christian community. But the reason they were there, the thing that was on their hearts, was that their churches were dying. And we know this is true across the board. Churches are deep in decline. You ever want a really good time? Go to the PCUSA website, click on congregations, pick any of the famous congregations that we have in our denomination, and look at the charts. They're all going down, every one of them. Brief moments on occasion, you get a brand new pastor, up, click, tick, boop. But by and large, there are very few churches that are not in decline. We evangelicals used to say, well, that's because of theology, you know, that we're becoming more progressive. Well, up until about the year 2000, you could have said that most evangelical churches were the ones that were still growing, up until the year 2000. For the past 13 years, most evangelical churches have been in decline. There's a few bright lights out there, a few places, and some of you are probably pastoring those churches, and it's praise be to God. But in general, we know the churches are dying. We know the generational shifts. We know what's happening with those who are under 35. We are deeply aware that the fastest growing religious group in the country are nuns, N-O-N-E-S, right? Spiritual but not religious. And we know that we're in a season of deep change, and most of us aren't quite sure what to do about it. And a friend of mine is about ready to retire. He's been a pastor for 40 years in Alabama, right in the buckle of the Bible Belt. He's been right in it from the very beginning. And so he said to me, he said, you know, Todd, 40 years ago, we never talked about church growth, church membership. We never worried about numbers. It was just stuff we used to send in at the end of the year. We never worried about it at all. Never even crossed our minds. Because when I started ministry 40 years ago in Alabama, it was really simple. If a man, skipped church on Sunday, his boss asked him about it on Monday. All of culture supported church. Everybody did, all the time. Everybody understood that. Friendship Sunday was made up by a bunch of vice president and business execs in places that said, Friendship Sunday's easy. All that week, we'll walk through this church. Those of us who run companies will walk through our company and ask people, so where are you going to church on Sunday? When the boss asks you, where are you going to church? You say, well, by the way, sir, where are you go? Where do you go? And people would show up. We now know it's a totally different day. We live in a day in which that is completely different than it was a generation ago. I have on my desk a newspaper from November 1963, one week, 8 days after John F. Kennedy was assassinated. It has on the front page the announcement that the Warren Commission is being called, and on the back page of that same section, there was an article about the 9,000-member Hollywood Presbyterian Church. And that's why I have it, is one of my church members gave it to me. But what they didn't notice is what immediately drew my eye is that in the corner was there in the LA Times was Bible readings for the day. The LA Times used to help you do your morning devotional. Every single day, the LA Times printed Bible readings for the day, 1963, one generation ago. We live in a dramatically different world. And some of us, it's happened even in the 10 years of the churches that we've been with. I moved to San Clemente. It's right in the middle of red Republican Orange County. It's about the most red Republican center in Orange County. It's where President Nixon is known as that guy who had some trouble at the end of his tenure, but he opened the surf spot, Trestles, right? I mean, in this place where I went 16 years ago, at least 16 years ago, when I would run into my church members on Sunday morning who had skipped church, if I ran into them, at least they had the good sense to be ashamed when they saw me, right? They would look at me and make excuses about how they're going to be in church, and they'd see them. Today, I run into church members. They're fresh from the gym, swirling their triple latte at Starbucks, and they look at me and go, "Pastor, how was it today? We're going to come back right after the soccer season." And we know this. We see this in every single place. There used to be a day when the culture supported Christianity, when every single town was built around the notion that in the very center of town, you have a library, you have a city hall, and you have the first church of whoever got there first, right? The Methodists, the Baptists, the Lutherans, the Presbyterians. All the rest of us had to put our first churches on Second Street. But whoever got there first got first church on First Street, on downtown. And today we now live in a world where at least in Southern California, red Republican Southern California, we've had at least one city who's used eminent domain to take away a church property so they could put in a big box store. We live in a totally, totally different day than we used to. And most of us were not prepared for this change that has happened so dramatically in one lifetime. Leslie Newbegin wrote, "If Western societies have become post-Christian mission fields, how can traditional churches become then missionary churches?" And for most of us who've spent most of our professional life working on the notion of the missional question, this is it. This is the transformation. This is the challenge for every seminary. It's the challenge for every church that's raising up new staff. It's the challenge for every pastor. I believe it will be the challenge for the next generation. It's either going to be starting new missionary churches or it's going to be transforming traditional churches into missionary churches. And it's in a completely different field and mindset that we find ourselves in today. So for the last couple of years, some of you have heard me tell this story. It's one of my favorites. I've been basically going around the country telling this story about Lewis and Clark as a metaphor for the kind of challenges we face. And over the next couple of days, what I want to do is build on this story. Today, set up the premise, and the next two talks together talk about the process that we need to learn, how to be trained differently as leadership, and then the kind of persons we need to be on Wednesday night. So tonight is the preposition, tomorrow the process, and then the third day the person. So Lewis and Clark. Most of you know that Lewis and Clark were on an expeditionary venture to find a water route. That was their job. It was to find a water route. The water route that would basically unite this brand new nation that we had just bought from the French. Now, here's what you needed to know about the water route. Everybody knew there was a water route. There was some way that you could get from the Mississippi River to the Pacific Ocean. Everybody knew it was there. They'd been looking for it for 300 years. It was so deeply important that whoever found it, it would be today like owning the internet. It would absolutely dominate the economics of the day. And so Jefferson sent out Lewis and Clark to find the water route. They would go up the Mississippi River, where the Mississippi River turns into the Missouri River, up in what is North Dakota and Montana. They would take it all the way, they would take it to its source, and they would find this pesky connection to what is now called the Columbia River on the other side that would take them all the way to the Pacific Ocean. Everybody knew it was there. For 300 years, there are maps drawn from that time that show this water route that they believed that was there. They just needed to find it. It was so incredibly important that the Spanish sent two war parties to intercept and kill Lewis and Clark, because if they found it, they knew that this new fledgling nation would dominate the entire continent. It was that important. So they took off, Lewis and Clark, up the Mississippi River, across the Missouri River. They wintered in North Dakota with the Mandan tribe, and the Mandans told them about the terrain. They told them they're going to go off the maps, but there's a couple of landmarks they could look for. One was there would be a giant waterfall, so big that they would have to carry their canoes around them. It took them a month to get around what we now know as the Great Falls of Montana. And then they would find themselves at an opportunity where they would have to take their canoes over mountains, and then they would get to the other side and they would find the water route. On August 12, 1805, in the journals of one of the men, they described the joy of having their feet on each side of a tiny little trickle that would become the Missouri River. They'd followed it all the way up to its source. Now, with one foot on each side, they had pulled out their canoes. They looked up, and they believed they had a half-day portage. They would carry their canoes up over the top of this ridge. They would go down the other side, and after 3 years of going upstream, they would now get to go downstream. And you all know what they found. The Rocky Mountains. You need to understand this. Nobody of American, continental American descent, nobody had seen the Rocky Mountains. As a matter of fact, they had no mental model for the Rocky Mountains. They'd been told by the Mandans there are mountains. But what they were thinking was Shenandoah Mountains, right? You ever been to Shenandoah National Park? Anybody been to Virginia? You ever seen what a mountain looks like on the East Coast? No offense to any of you from those parts. But I'm from California. We'd have turned those suckers into condos years ago. Those ain't no mountains. We got foothills in Southern California that are bigger than that, that no one ever spends time even hiking, let alone calling them a national park. These are mountains. The Rocky Mountains, nobody had even considered. Think about this. No mental model with 14,000 foot peaks that roll on for hundreds and hundreds of miles. Meriwether Lewis wrote in his journal, "It was the most horrible sight I'd ever seen." It was August. Winter is coming. They were canoers. Their entire mental model was they would go upstream. This would be the hard part. And as soon as they crossed over, they would have a small little walk, and then they would get to go downstream. Everybody assumed that what was in front of them was exactly the same as what was behind them, that they would go downstream all the way to the Pacific Ocean, and then they would start the long journey back after they got a little rest. It was going to be that easy. They were going to go home, and they were going to make it. And at this moment, they realized everything they assumed about what was in front of them was dead wrong. They were canoers, and they had to figure out how to go over mountains. And this is exactly where some of us are in our churches, exactly this moment. We have been operating for a generation believing that what is in front of us is exactly the same as what's been behind us. That we're really, really good at canoeing. We're water folk. You put us in a canoe, you give us a direction, you send us to go find a river, and we're really great at it. If we can just keep canoeing, we're doing fine. But what happens when you run out of river, when the landscape changes entirely? What happens when the landscape around us changes so radically that absolutely everything we assume is wrong? What happens when you find yourself needing to canoe over mountains? You know, it's interesting. I really think, by the way, I really do believe that if Meriwether Lewis and William Clark had at that moment stopped and gone back, we would still have hailed them as heroes. They would have been the ones who would have proved scientifically, and they were men of the Enlightenment, that there is no water route. They would have gone home. They would have been told, yes, you proved the point, and they would have been able to go home. Their charge was to find the water route. But at that moment, they had this huge decision to make. Are we about finding the water route, or are we about exploring this new terrain, going off the map into uncharted territory and doing something that nobody else has ever done before? And that's exactly the place where most of us in church leadership are today. Every time I go to Denver, I remember this guy who once said, look, Denver, Colorado was founded by a group of people who had braved the entire prairies, all the hardships, all the wind, all the dangers, everything. They'd gotten right to this place. They'd looked up and said, far enough. This is good. We're going to stop right here. We're going to stop in this spot. This is a good spot. It's a good place. And many of us, that's where we find ourselves in our careers. We've spent our entire life with Christendom behind us, with the understanding of that the church is, this is the way the church was built. It's what we were trained to do. It's what leadership was about. It's about what it meant to do ministry. We knew we weren't missionaries. We didn't sign up for pit helmets and going cross-cultural. We had people who did that. We signed up to work in this culture, in this chance time, and to minister to these people in this place. We're canoers, and we've run out of water. Meriwether Lewis and William Clark at that moment did an amazing thing, an almost unthinkable thing. They left the canoes, and they turned to a nursing mother, a nursing Native American mother. And they asked her to help them find horses so they could continue the journey. It's an incredible example of change and the kind of creative leadership that we're being called to at exactly this moment. My friends, most of us always default to our training. We always go back to the things that we've learned in the past. If the 1963 ever came back again, we Presbyterians are ready. We'll have them nailed. We got it, right? My friend Steve Yamaguchi is my executive presbyter, and he tells this story, and he lets me tell the story all over the place. He had, for years, his spiritual director was a Vincentian priest whose brother was a jet fighter pilot. Imagine Thanksgiving at their house, right? For one year for his birthday, the jet fighter pilot took the priest into a jet fighter simulator and let him experience what it's like being in a jet fighter simulator. While in the jet, after the whole experience was over, the priest got out, talked to the Marine Corps instructor, and said to him, "Why do you guys believe so much in using simulators for all the things you do?" And he said something to him that he said that he's remembered, he's never forgotten. He said, "At the moment of crisis, you will not rise to the occasion, you default to your training." At the moment of crisis, you don't rise to the occasion, you default to your training. And this is good biblical stuff. What we believe all the time, what our culture wants to tell us, what romance novels want to tell us, what adventure stories want to tell us, is that at the moment of crisis, we will become somebody different than we are. But the scriptures tell us that we need to be trained up in the way we will go. And however we are trained, we will default back to. And when lives are on the line, what our military knows and what pilots know is that you need to train for those experiences. Remember the miracle on the Hudson? Do you remember Chelsea Sullenberger, who landed the U.S. Airways plane on the Hudson River? He took off out of New York's LaGuardia Airport. He took off. Within 2 minutes, birds had gone into his engines. They knocked both of them out. And within two minutes, they were all in a dive, and he had to land the plane on the Hudson River. Nobody was killed. He was a hero. He was lauded all over the country. He became the Grand Marshal of the Rose Parade, which is a big dang deal. And over again, he was interviewed. And when he was interviewed, he was asked the same question every time. What were you thinking about in those last 2 minutes? What was going through your head? Were you thinking about how you lived your life? Were you thinking about your family? Were you trying to fire off a text to tell your family that you loved them? What were you thinking about in those last 2 minutes? Chelsea Sullenberger looked at every single one of those people and he said, "What I was doing for those 2 minutes was landing the plane." We had trained for this. One of the members of my church works for United Airlines. He's one of the guys who goes in after there has been a tragedy and does the debrief with whoever is left behind, and he does the debrief with whatever crew needs to experience kind of people helping them process. And he said there is an entire protocol that every pilot who flies out of there learns for landing the plane on the Hudson River because they trained for it. My folks, our big problem is that we've not been trained for the world that we've inherited. We've not been trained for the landscape that's in front of us. We were trained for the church that is behind us. We were trained as canoers, not mountain people. And over again, we have to ask ourselves, what do you do in default mode? What have you been trained to do? I figured out I have basically three things that I've been trained to do as a pastor. If I have a problem, I either preach about it, or I create programs about it, or I add pastor my personal touch, right? What I call talking longer, old tricks, and trying harder, right? Somebody comes to me and says, "Young adults aren't as interested in discipleships. We can't get adults into Bible studies, Pastor. The amount of spiritual formation in the church is going down. Biblical literacy is going down. People aren't as interested. What are we going to do?" And what do? We do a sermon series. In the middle of the sermon series, when we're not sure if that's going to work, we turn to our associate pastors. The pastor's a program, right? And we tell them to run a program, right? To go along with the sermon series. And if that doesn't work, well then, Pastor, maybe if you would disciple a few people. Maybe if you would start getting a few folks together. And pretty soon you know this is the tricks we have in our bag and what we've been trained. And they're great tricks. But what if these things don't work? One of my friends, Morgan Murray, likes to say, "We Presbyterians are so good at talking about problems that after a while we think we've actually done something." Right? You ever done that? You ever had the year of evangelism, the year of renewal, the year of the Holy Spirit? Then after you said, we've done evangelism, renewal, and the Holy Spirit, now what are we going to do, right? We've talked about it. We think we've done it. I mean, I'm good at talking. I've been talking longer than anything else I've done. You know the studies that it takes 10,000 hours to become an expert? The only thing I've ever done in my life for 10,000 hours is talk. And so if the only tricks and the only things I know how to do are preach or program or try harder, personal touch, what happens when they don't work? What happens when you can't get a sermon series good enough to get people interested in the church? When you plan programs, here's my favorite. Do studies of your environment, of your community. Bring in consultants to tell you what people's felt needs are. Plan those programs, and you tell me what happens. Nobody shows up. They don't show up. Programs are not. What do you do when our old tricks don't work anymore? What's the nature of our biggest challenges? Actually, they're systemic problems. They're not clear answers. And the kind of thinking that we've used before to get there isn't going to help us go forward because we haven't even imagined these. We haven't imagined the future in front of us any more than Meriwether Lewis and William Clark imagined that they would need to survive by calling upon a nursing Native American woman in a moment of crisis. We can't even imagine the things that are in front of us. We were trained for a different context. We were trained for rivers, not mountains, and we need to learn a new way of leading. And essentially what I want to suggest to those of us, especially those of us who know that we're at a place in our careers or in our lives or our ministries, that the church has called us forward, that the uncharted territory in front of us is the charge that we've been given. We might wish that we could keep canoeing. I spend a lot of my time with a number of my colleagues. I had three of my friends all lose their job on one day. All three, all in their 50s, all Orthodox, none of them had a single problem, not an ethic problem, not a theology problem, nothing. Except that all three churches were in conflict about the future and they were in leadership conflict. And all three of my friends lost their jobs on the same day. I often think, you know, if only there was a bit more river, a little longer, maybe just to get us to retirement. But this is the day we've been given. And particularly for those who are coming up behind us, this was the once young Presbyterian pastors' conference. What do you think? What do we say to the young Presbyterian pastors today who are starting the journey on the top of the mountain and they're not being told they can even use the rivers or count on them? For me, one of the teachers for me has been Harvard professor Ronald Heifetz. He says, start thinking about this, and I know some of you are familiar with these terms, and by tomorrow we're going to talk more about going from knowing the terms into the process of learning how to lead this. He says there's a difference in the different kinds of problems we face. He says some of them are technical problems versus adaptive challenges. That if you start to think about your problems differently, you'll start to see some different ways to look at your potential solutions. Technical problems versus adaptive challenges. A technical problem is one that applies current knowledge, skills, and tools to resolve a situation. A technical problem is one on which we actually can find the technology. It doesn't mean technology this way, and it also doesn't mean that it's a simple problem, right? A heart valve bypass is a very complicated technical problem. There are very important technical problems that we need to solve, and many of us have been trained to do so, exegeting the scriptures, exegeting the second Isaiah passages of the and trying to make sense of them in exile texts today in a world of consumerist to Christianity. That's a tough technical problem, right? Caring for people who are grieving and dying, right? Talking to parents who have to bury their children or children burying their parents. Those are really important. But there is wisdom out there and there's training out there and most of us have been trained to do it very, very well. Adaptive challenges are different. Adaptive challenges means they can't be solved with existing knowledge, skills, and tools. There's no best practices you can turn to. It requires people who are in the midst of the organizational system to make a shift in values, expectations, attitudes, or habits of behavior. There are systemic problems with no clear answers. Adaptive challenges you can begin to notice because they have a different flavor to them. There's a cycle of failure. We've been in these problems a while. There's a flight to authority. We're on our third adult education pastor. There's a chorus of complaints. We start to realize that these problems that we have are now just because somebody's cranky. They're showing up over and over and over again. That the same old fight. Those of us who've been married for a while know this, right? My wife's a marriage and family therapist. I'm married to a professional. So I can say, in her professional opinion, we have had the same fight for 24 years. It shows up in one season of our lives as a fight over sex, in another season of our life, and a fight over chores, another season of our life, a fight over money. But it's basically the same fight. It's part of the way and the dance that we do as married couples. We're better at it now than we were then, praise be to God. But it's a deeper thing than whatever the system is. And mostly it's the result of yesterday's successes. And this is the trickiest part. You know the churches that have the hardest time thinking about being missional churches? You know the whole notion, the church is the mission field. We are the church is the people sent in the mission to the neighborhood around us. We are the mission outpost, and we are the ones called in the mission. You know the churches have the hardest time? It's the churches that have a really big map filled with pictures of missionaries. The churches that were wildly successful at sending money over seawater have a very hard time transitioning to a missional future. The churches where we did things, I mean, the church that has a great choral music program has a very hard time adapting to a few guitars and praise songs, right? Wherever we've had success, deep success that's made a difference is where we have problems today. And our problems today are the result of yesterday's successes. I always say Presbyterians don't struggle with yesterday's failures. We're very good at sweeping those under the rug, right? It's yesterday's successes that continue to haunt us. And adaptive challenges are those same ones done over and over and over again. Sound familiar? There are four types of adaptive challenges. We'll spend some time looking at these more tomorrow. There's a gap between espoused values and behaviors. Like when we say one thing and we do another. When we say we're evangelical, and yet we don't have many adult baptisms. When we say we care about the future and children, and yet we don't have much in the way of children's ministries. When we have a gap between espoused values and behaviors. When we have competing commitments, especially competing valuable commitments. Do we care for the stakeholders? Do we take care of and love the people who've got us this place? Or do we care for those, or do we make as a priority the people who need to know the gospel? Which one do you do? And the longer in ministry, the harder that thing becomes. This last week, I was sitting there looking at my congregation in the middle of communion. I stand up and I watch them. We do communion every week in our church. And I sat there and I saw right there sitting on the aisle was Paul. 4 years ago, Paul was on a bike ride with me for over 200 miles over 4 days. 4 years ago. Today, last week, 2 weeks ago, he sat back down during communion, his frail body giving out. He'll never come forward to take communion again. Now we take communion to him. I watched this beautiful saint, this man. I've been with pastors, I've been with younger pastors who said stuff, look, the problem with the Presbyterian church is it's all filled with old people. You know, after 16 years, those are my old people. Those are my people. So when you tell me that part of what we have to do in the church is to care for the stakeholders and the older generation, I look at you and say, absolutely we are. But I also know that we're called to take the hill, to go over the mountain. One of my friends came out of corporate America, and he likes to say that he's one of those pastors that loves hugging and kissing and taking care of the saints of the church. He's got a ministry. It's a small retirement church and a small retirement community. And I asked him what he loves about it. He just tears up. He goes, it's an incredible privilege for me, Todd. After all those years in kind of cutthroat corporate America, now I get to be the priest and minister to the saints going on to glory. I hug them and I kiss them and I love them and I take care of them. It's just an incredible thing. And they hug and kiss and love and take care of me. And I always say, he's the kind of guy who takes care of grandma. We need pastors like that. But I've always seen myself as kind of one of those take the hill guys. I want to be on the front lines. I want to be doing the challenge. I want to be taking up, going off and saying, folks, the gospel takes us forward. The kingdom is in front of us. Let's go and let's take the hill. And he'll look at me and go, that's the kind of guy you are. And I'll look at him and say, you're the one who takes care of grandma. And the hardest thing for us to deal with is that the church means we got to take grandma over the hill. And at times those things compete with each other. Or adaptive challenges are built around speaking the unspeakable. Not just the immoral and unspeakable, but the unspeakable about priorities, about the way that so many of our decisions really are made around either certain groups or certain people, about how often we feel the pressures and the power. Will we be able to survive as a church if certain key donors stop giving? Will we be able to go forward if certain key families are not happy? Will we be able to go? Will we be able to continue to have a church? Will you even have a job? The things that we never say and that we feel all the time. Most of the work I do with TAG is mostly just to coach pastors. I spend time walking alongside of them because pastors, in all their good intended, want to lead the church into the future. They start an entire visioning process. They bring in Kevin Ford. We do an assessment. We get all excited about the future. They set missional direction. And the person who has the failure of nerve is usually the pastor. Because the pastor starts to have to grapple with, what if this church needs someone that I'm not? And my job is to be the one who walks alongside the pastor, helping the pastor continue to lead, even if it might mean him leading himself right out of a position, herself right out of a position. Or very often, adaptive challenges are about work avoidance. You know you're in the middle of an adaptive challenge when people are either distracting or blaming. And very often we'll find so many of our problems are about distraction and blaming. How many times have we sat in gatherings together and blamed some other faction of the church for the problems that we have in our congregation? How many times have we found ourselves saying, our problem is this, and we blamed it? Or we found ourselves doing the kinds of work that can actually distract us from the work we've done. I mean, we Presbyterians, what we're really, really good at is putting the chairs in a circle and arguing about old issues, aren't we? We have a very hard time gathering people together and trying to talk about confronting new challenges like the people outside our door who aren't interested in us at all. Adaptive challenges cannot be solved with one's existing knowledge, skills, and tools. And so the moment of leadership crisis that most of us find is also the most transformative words we can possibly say. It's when we find ourselves knowing that what worked before doesn't work anymore, and we find ourselves saying, I don't know. I don't know what the future holds. I've never been here. I'm off the map. I wasn't trained for this. I wasn't prepared for this. I coach a clergy couple in the Pacific Northwest, and last week, the wife looked at me and said, we didn't get any of this in seminary. I don't even know how to have the next conversation. I don't know how to have this next conversation with my session. I have no idea what to do. Every single thing we've ever thought we've done up to this point is basically showing us that it's not worked so far. I don't know what to do. And this is the moment, the leadership moment for that couple in that church at that moment. In times of great change, learners inherit the earth, while the learned find themselves beautifully equipped for a world that no longer exists. I like to share this with my seminary professor colleagues, those of us who are experts, who worked really, really hard to get a PhD. Do we end up talking about those of us who've been senior pastors or have gotten a sense of have some kind of success in our lives? Have we become experts for a world that no longer exists? So what works? Shifting. That's what Heifetz would say. Shifting is close to repenting, to be honest. It's reconsidering your strategy for living, Dallas Willard would put it. It's rethinking and reframing the whole problem. It's thinking in a whole different direction. It's shifting your beliefs and habits and values so that you can see the problem in a new light. It's beginning to think, I'm no longer a canoer, I'm an adventurer. I'm not a water guy, I'm an adventurer who's going off the map. I don't need canoes, I need horses. And I'm not going to rely only on my history. I'm going to rely on new voices sitting in front of me like a nursing Native American woman. Shifting. It's figuring out what kind of challenge you're facing and then shifting the system to discover new strategies for addressing that challenge. And so there's a few principles I'll just let you mull on until tomorrow. Number one, you know you're doing adaptive work when you have to give the solution work back to the people who experience the problem most greatly. I often ask pastors, is there anybody else losing sleep over this but you? Is there anybody else in the church who cares about this but you? Are you the only one pacing in the middle of the night? Are you the only one that holds this? How can you give this work back to the people? Are you the only one who's worried about the fact that nobody wants to darken your door? Are you the only one who notices it? Is the church actually happy with its kind of complacent decline? Or how do we give the work back to the people who experience the problem most greatly? In our church, we began to talk about the fact that discipleship for the next generation, we knew wasn't going to happen through throwing more money or more program at it. If you paid any attention to Fuller's work that Kara Powell is doing out of the Fuller Youth Institute or the studies that Christian Smith have done, we know that most of our generation, most of us who ran youth ministries, based on the best technology and the best wisdom that we were all told about how to do youth work and youth discipleship for the last generation, has basically produced a generation of young adults and into now young married adults who basically don't have a Christian theology that sticks and endures. So for most of us, including me, for most of the things we were taught about how to run programs don't work. And yet, if those of us who are sitting in this room, most of us got to the positions we got to because we did a really, really great job of producing programs that didn't produce fruit. And so we're the experts for the last generation, and people look to us. And the worst part is we got parents our age sitting out there who want for their children and their grandchildren the same programs that we had, remember? They want lock-ins, and they want pillow fights and mud bowls. And they want big youth programs in a day when kids have plenty to do, too much to do, and are not interested. And we can't figure out what do we do with it. The data shows really, really clearly, really clearly, that if you want the next generation to be disciples of Jesus Christ, the most important people to be Christians are the parents. The parents have to pass on faith. Try telling that to parents. I sat down with a group of parents and said, look, we're going to have more parental involvement. We're changing our Sunday schools. We're changing our youth programs. We have now looked at the data. We've seen the response. We understand, you know, that if we want your kids to have faith that's going to remain, we need more parents involved. We need you to take a hand. We'll have staff who will equip you and work with you. And I remember having a mom look at me and say to me, this church, you cannot raise a problem without having someone tell you you have to be part of the solution. I said, exactly right. And she looked at me and said those words that every pastor hears on occasion, right? So what are we paying you for? My mind went blank. Because what I wanted to say, I probably shouldn't. But since then, I've come up with the answer. And I'm waiting for the next time. You know what you pay me for? To stand here and tell you that. To stand here and tell you that the future, that this church requires everyone who comes up, sees a problem, to take on the solution. That we believe in the priesthood of all believers, and that we believe that parents are the very best disciples of their children, and that we are going to provide all the staff necessary and all the program necessary to help us be families of people who pass on our faith. We're going to do it wholeheartedly, but you're going to have to be involved in it, and you pay me to sit here and disappoint you at a rate I hope you can absorb. Adaptive work is where we pastor the process, and for most of us, that means having to escape the expert expectation. Our congregation expects us to be experts, because we're experts usually, most of us are experts in the one thing they can't possibly understand as well. We're experts usually in the Bible. In most of our congregations, unless you have Dale Bruner in your congregation, but in most of our congregations, most of us are the smartest person in the room about the Bible. We're the most competent at teaching. We're the person who likes to stand up and speak the most. We're the best preacher. I mean, number one fear of most Americans is death. Number two is public speaking, which means that in most gag funerals, half the people would rather be the person in the box than the person doing the eulogy, right? Since we stand up every single week and we do what they cannot do, which is speak to large groups of people about the Bible they don't understand, they then assume we're experts at everything. And most of us have our investment and our identity in being seen as experts. I mean, let's face it, we have a weird job. When you do your job well, this is the weirdest thing in the world. When I do my job well, I finish doing my job, people line up to thank me and tell me they love me. I don't ever remember lining up for my plumber. You know, I'll thank him, but I've never hugged him and told him I love you and I pray for you every day, right? But we pastors, we get this. They so appreciate what we do. They want us to be the expert and we buy into it. And it's so deeply difficult for us to hold on to the ability to disappoint them. That the problem in front of us is not like the problem behind us. We don't know how to do it. We don't have any idea how we're going to get grandma over this mountain, but we are going. And we need your help to do it. You give the solution work back to those who experience the problem most greatly. Leadership consists of learning required to address the conflicts in the values people hold and diminish the gap between the values people stand for and the reality they face. And that takes engagement of people owning the problem. Key adaptive principle 2, just got 3 of them for you tonight. The new solution to our challenge will be a healthy adaptation of the DNA of the group. Your future is going to look something like your past, but different. It's going to be an adaptation. That's exactly what it's about. As the culture around us changes, as the environment around us changes, we need to find the thing that is like us, but not like us. The thing that's consistent with our code, our values, our DNA, and is a healthy expression of it. For years, I showed this picture at our church. Blew it up to 8 feet wide. This is the earliest picture we have of our church. It's an early beach Bible study. When we were tearing down all of our buildings, this is the picture we wanted people looking at, because this picture said why we were tearing down our buildings. We were tearing them down because we were going to be a church that no matter what else we did, we were going to be about the Bible and multi-generations about the Bible. And it also didn't hurt when I was trying to call our first woman pastor. This is who we are. This is our code. We're a church that is a multi-generational church that is centered around the scriptures. Every single thing we do is going to be about this. And no matter what else changes, what will never change in our church is that we will be in a multi-generational church that is centered around the scriptures. That will never change. I just recently had one of our saints pass away, Ruth Kaiser. She used to come up to me every single week and she would say, boy, she could get away with calling me boy, boy, I pray for you every day. I'd say, please pray for me, Ruth. It's hard. We've had big challenges we've had to do. We have big things we're doing. We're tearing down all of our buildings. We're rebuilding our campus. We're trying to reach out to people who aren't interested in the church. She said, well, I pray for you every day. And what I pray for you, boy, is that you never stray from preaching the Bible. Genesis to Revelation, every single week, you preach the Bible, boy. That's what I pray for you. Whenever you're trying to bring change, the key reality is you must figure out and determine what will never change. And then you must be prepared to change anything and everything else. What didn't change for Lewis and Clark is they were going to find their way to the Pacific Ocean. They were going to complete the task, even if they had to ditch the canoes and admit they'd failed at the thing they'd been sent out for. Determine what will never change, and then be prepared to change anything and everything else. And believe me, that's a lot of work on both sides. And the third principle is people don't resist change, they resist loss. If you're the person who spent the whole winter digging the canoe, it's a really bad day when you run out of water. If you're the person who really doesn't like the cold and has got a problem with altitude, you don't like when you run into mountains. And if you're the person who has a bias against Native Americans or women, it's really, really hard when all of a sudden you realize your life depends upon them. People don't resist change, they resist loss. And for those of us as pastors, this is actually probably the best bit of news I've given you this whole evening. Because you know what we're being really good and trained at? Grief work. Every single thing we've ever learned, every CPE class we ever had to take, every experience we ever had at a bedside, every time we've ever had to stay with people who are going through grief and loss has prepared us for this moment. Because what the church mostly needs to grapple with is the loss of the Christendom status of our culture. That it's never coming back. That we'll never be in the center of culture ever again. That at least for a generation. Go read The Exile again. I read Jeremiah 29. We did 7 weeks in Jeremiah 29 for our congregation. You know everybody's favorite verse? For I know the plans I have for you, says the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you a future and hope. He says to a group of people who he just said are going to die in the exile. Because for 70 years you're going to be there. You know what your future and your hope is? Your grandchildren are going to have their prayers answered. We need to prepare an entire generation that may never see the glory days of 1963 when LA Times would put Bible verses on the newspaper. But prepare a church to be faithful into that future. People don't resist change, they resist loss. So we have to get beyond win-win solutions. Win-win is lose-lose. Which means that when we're talking about taking grandma over the mountain, that usually grandma doesn't want to go. Or people don't want to go over the mountain. And we have to become the kind of folks who say someone's going to lose. Something's going to lose. It might be 1-1A, it may be this moment, but when you're making decisions, we're going to be helping people deal with loss. And the last principle is expect sabotage. Remember that it is disappointing your own people at a rate they can absorb. Very often, the folks who will be the most resistant to change are the people who've been the people who've got you here. The people who brought you, the people who believe that you're to be the solution, the people who want you to be the expert, the very same people you've cared for are going to be the ones who are going to turn on you, the ones who want you to stay gathered around the campfire, taking care of grandma, telling stories about the water route, are going to be the ones who get in the way when you tell them we've got to move, that we're going into uncharted territory. Leadership is disappointing your own people at a rate they can absorb. So you have to prepare for disappointment. If you have time to talk and consider things I want you to consider, and perhaps the conversations we can have around us over the next few days or around these questions, just talk about how the church has changed in your lifetime. 1963, 4 months before I was born, my lifetime. The LA Times had gone from being those who would help you have your quiet time to today, we live in a culture in which cities will take up church properties by eminent domain, one lifetime. Describe the uncharted territory we're in today. What it's like to be a person who was trained for canoes and is heading over mountains. And then think hard about what it will require of us as leaders, wherever we find ourselves in the middle of this process. Close with this story. So in our church, one of our continual struggles has been to figure out how do we reach this young adult generation. My worship leader, Brianne, was turning 30, so she invited all the staff, including those of us who were a bit older, to come to her birthday party, and we were going to do karaoke. We started dividing the room into half. It was those who needed their reading glasses to read the karaoke lists, and those who could just pick it out. And those of us who were on the older side, who were trying to figure out whether or not we could get everybody to sing along with us to Twist and Shout, were in the middle of a conversation while the younger crowd was on the other side, and I looked over at the younger folks gathered around getting ready to do karaoke, and I realized that I knew every single one of those people. They'd all been in our church at one time or another, and that they weren't there today. So I sat there through the whole party asking myself the question, these are Brianne's friends. Brianne's on my staff. She's our worship leader. She leads our contemporary worship. She's really, really, really good. So I went to Brianne and I said, Brianne, I want to ask you a question. All your friends at your party, it was incredible to see them. It was so fun, but it was like a reunion of people who used to go to our church. Where are they today? And she kind of hemmed and hawed, and we talked about stuff, and we talked about different weddings we've done. And I said, do you think they'd be willing to talk to me about that? So we put together a group of folks to talk to me about why they don't go to our church anymore. And we began to experiment with ways to reach the next generation. And one of the experiments we started was a Sunday night service that was really cool. It had candles. It was in the evening. I thought about getting a tattoo, you know? And it was really great for about 6 months. And then it died too. And I remember in one of those services sitting there praying about getting ready to get up and talk. And I felt like this still small voice in a still small worship service said to me words that I wonder are words for our generation. Your people need you to lead them even more than preach to them. I wonder if what the church needs is a group of folks who are willing to say, we know it's different, and we're going to spend the rest of our ministries, even if we die in the uncharted territory, going forward. Learning what we need to learn, taking the church into the future, preparing the way for the next generation. Your people need you to lead them even more than preach to them. Maybe it's just me. Maybe this is just my call. But I have a hunch that the future of the church is going to be built upon more people considering that reality than we used to think. Let me pray for us. Lord Jesus, I thank you for these friends. I thank you for the history and the years they've shared, for the ministries they've had, for the fruit that has been born. I thank you for the great days they've had on the water and the adventures they've seen and the lives they've touched and the churches they've led. I thank you for the fruit that remains and the fruit that is going forth in the world. I thank you for every good thing. And I also thank you for sisters and brothers who are willing to look into an uncharted future and wonder if you are calling us to lead in a new way for a new day. I pray that you will give us the courage we need to be humble to learn, to admit when we don't know, and to consider what you may wish to do in and through our lives. And we pray that in all the things that you have given us to do, that we would do them according to your power and by your wisdom. Bless this time together for the rest of the week we have. In the name of Christ, amen.